This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies on iTunes and via the web. I'm your host, Nick Cheeseman, a member of the Institute for Advanced Study, Princeton. Today I'm joined by Doreen Lee, an Associate Professor of Anthropology at Northeastern University, to talk about Activist Archives, Youth Culture and the Political Past in Indonesia, published this year, 2016, by Duke University Press. Doreen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
You write in the book's introduction that you began to take an interest in youth politics and street politics in Indonesia in 2002. And by that time, of course, the New Order regime, against which activists had fought for some three decades, had already collapsed. What was it about youth activism in the years after the fall of Suharto that first attracted your attention, and how did you settle on it as a topic for research that culminated in this wonderful book?
Yes. So I write about my process of entering the field a little bit in the introduction to the book, but I think perhaps I need to explain a little bit more about why a movement that began in 1998 was still attractive several years later. And if anyone was paying attention to of contentious politics in Southeast Asia, they would have known that demonstrations were still occurring basically every day, or at least every few days, in major cities across Indonesia, and that several new movements, whether it was labor or environment or indigenous rights movements, had also formed alongside the original democracy movement led by students in 1998. So I was quite fortunate to be able to pick up on a kind of thriving democratic culture and a very new democratic culture in Indonesia in 2002, which was about when I started going to the field and conducting my research.
Did you just stumble into Indonesia studies as a result of doing research as a graduate student, or is there something more to the story?
So the answer is yes and no, of course. I actually grew up in Indonesia, but I grew up as a member of a minority group. So my family is ethnically Chinese. My mother is Indonesian, but my father is not. So I kind of had a very removed life as a child, a kind of expatriate life, quite removed from politics. And of course, part of the fact was that There were many restrictions on Chinese participation in civic life in Indonesia. So I really did miss the rumblings of popular dissent in the 90s, because Indonesia still looked like an Asian tiger at that point, where the focus was on development, economic development, foreign direct investment, and so on and so forth. So when 1998 happened and Suharto resigned, I was already in college in the U.S., and it came as a great shock to me. So it became a sort of personal quest to understand these social transformations and to try to understand how politicization could occur across classes, across time and space, across all these cultural differences in Indonesia. And the yes part to the accidental stumbling was that I ended up at Cornell for graduate school, and I had entered the anthropology department, but I wasn't aware then that Cornell also boasted, you know, one of the oldest and most famous Southeast Asian studies programs in the U.S. So I was extremely lucky to be able to study at a university where Ben Anderson and Jim Siegel and other important historians and anthropologists and development sociologists and linguists had worked for a decade. So that sort of shows you that in some ways it was planned, and other ways I was just extremely fortunate to end up in the right place at the right time.
In any case, clearly the right combination for the research that followed. Now, you concentrate the book on this category of youth politics, pemuda politics, as you refer to it, and you track this category and its significance for political activism in Indonesia over successive generations from 1908 to 1998 and then thereafter. So perhaps before we proceed, I think it would be useful if you can set up that category for us, unpack it a bit. What do you mean when you refer to youth as a category for analysis of politics in Indonesia, past and present, and why does it matter anyway?
Yes, so if we start with the present and we start with the actual political phenomenon of youth activism in 1998 and student activism, it would appear that all of these changes and all of these new political subjects were emerging out of nowhere, as if this was a kind of globalized identity politics, as it were, right, where the call for democracy mirrored other movements going on elsewhere that were based on an understanding of human rights and democracy. But what really interested me, and this is part of the kind of blessing of being at Cornell, was that when I started learning more about Indonesian history, it became very evident in the historiography itself that the category of youth had existed for well over for a century, since the colonial era to the post-colonial era, and that the role of youth in politics had been really secured by this nationalist historiography, which posited youth as agents of change in Indonesia. So there was, in fact, a kind of, let's say, categorical exception within Indonesian history itself that called attention to youth over and over again, usually in times of crisis, in times of revolution, in times of war, and so on and so forth. But it also, I think, the most recent iteration of youth politics in Indonesia that I wrote about also matched up neatly with other aspects of youth culture. So in the book, for instance, I look at things like activist style. I look at how political culture enters into public culture in perhaps more fun and cheeky ways rather than kind of overtly ideological ways. So I think there are several meanings of youth that I deploy in this book, and they intersect nicely. And perhaps one common or comparative theme about youth that is useful to think about just through this Indonesian case study is that I think student activism itself has also emerged as an important political category to study. So it really is a sort of set of overlapping political definitions that can cohere in the figure of the Indonesian activist.
We'll turn to style and perhaps go into some of the spaces that your fieldwork occupies shortly. But before we do that, I'd like to pick up on this point and work with it a little bit more. You could have written a history of youth activism in Indonesia, say, up to 1998. And in some ways, that's part of your story. But really, what you talk about is to use your own terms, the youth politics in the present as having a feeling of belonging of an historically charged present. So what is it about the relationship between the histories of youth activism in Indonesia and youth activism in the present day that's interesting and important for the story that you're telling? And not just important in a descriptive sense, but also it goes to some of the explanations that you offer as to why it is that youth political activism has persisted well after the demise of dictatorship in Indonesia, whereas in other countries that we might look at, we find that it doesn't have that type of longevity.
Yes, I think that's an excellent question that gets at various aspects of what makes this case so interesting and perhaps in some ways unique and specific. I think what you've pointed out in your question is that the role of youth in politics has become really a cultural institution as well as an ideological feature that has really worked across several different types of regimes. And so one of the arguments that I have proposed in this book and why I do a little bit of investigation into the 1980s, the 1990s, and then 1998 and beyond, is to see what sustains this feeling of, let's say, a moral claim that youth have on the nation that isn't merely tied to kind of a more reactive politics or a kind of impending sense of crises, but rather really culminates from a sense that youth politics is a legacy that has been imparted to present and future generations in Indonesia. And of course, my work draws heavily on previous work done by other scholars, prominent Indonesianists such as Takashi Shiraishi or Benedict Anderson and Bill Frederick, Keith Fulcher as well, who've really looked at the importance of nationalism in Indonesian politics and how cultural styles of politics can be derived from quite radical traditions and then brought into the masses or brought into the mainstreams. And so what I was interested in doing in this book was simply to show that we can recognize how ideology implants itself in certain official narratives, but also in material culture, also in popular memory, also in collective memory.
So tell us a bit more about that material culture, in particular going to the title of the book, The Activist Archives, on which you drew to tell this story. Can you paint a picture, as it were, of these archives, give us a sense of what sort of materials you worked with and where you went to obtain them and any distinctive characteristics of their materiality that you think would really evoke the kinds of modes of inquiry that you undertook when you were doing your research?
Well, when I started doing field work, this was between 2003 to 2005, where I had an extended 18-month stay in Indonesia. It became very clear to me quite immediately that political culture was immensely productive and productive of things. So it wasn't just ideas or organizations, but rather what glued people together, what conjoined ideas to action was the production of a kind of a very rich visual corpus, a set of paraphernalia that was immensely important and necessary to the staging of street politics, the staging of youth politics. These included what people wore for specific demonstrations, so they would make T-shirts specifically to address certain issues, that they would make banners that would be reused or preserved, that they would then make documentaries and sort of create photographic evidence and filmic evidence of protests and certain incidents of violence, for instance, as well as an enormous kind of paper corpus of meeting reports, position papers, proposals, and such, you know, really a kind of broad range of materials that were really being downplayed, I think, in other studies and media reports about what activism was like. And so when I tried to theorize or think about activist culture, it became evident that it had to deal with the materiality of that culture, and it had to deal with the vast array of objects that were produced in the wake of these demonstrations and these meetings.
A lot of the stuff that you've just described is what formal institutions might refer to as ephemera, and the kind of material that may not be collected by or housed in national libraries, for instance, or other officially designated sites for archives. So in getting at this term that you use in the title of the book, Activist Archives, could you maybe literally unpack it for us? For instance, you tell stories about people coming with plastic bags full of papers and so on. How did you go about gathering up the materials, and where did you have to go both in Indonesia and abroad to find them and to draw this material together in a way that it would be a corpus that you could use for the research that culminated in the book?
Well, when I started the fieldwork initially, and I was attending a lot of demonstrations, and these were taking place in public space and kind of, you know, producing public space through the very presence of bodies and trucks and banners and so on and so forth, I was starting to theorize the street as an archive, because even more than 5 years or even up to 8 years after 1998 in the fall of Suharto, there were still no official archives that belonged to student movements, or there was no centralized archive within Indonesia or abroad that collected the breadth of materials produced by many diverse types of groups across the ideological spectrum. So it became clear to me that the kind of ephemera that was being generated at a very high volume was somehow disappearing. And yet, Indonesians had a strong sense of, let's say, activism about these materials themselves. So they would try to conserve it, but as I write in the book, there were often all these stories of lost objects, confiscated items, or missing things. So in the course of my fieldwork, as any other anthropologist would do, in addition to producing my own documentation through photographs and collecting items off the street and flyers and leaflets, I actively sought out materials, or people would offer materials from the past that they thought were important. And in so doing, I became a regular at certain photocopy shops and amassed a great deal of this information myself. And then I was fortunate several years later to be made aware of various Indonesian activist archives that were housed in the Netherlands at the International Institute of Social History in Amsterdam, that were direct donations from Indonesian activists themselves. And so I could consult those to provide a longer sort of time sequence for the type of activism I was studying, so all the way back to the 1980s.
One of the parts of the story which really fascinated me, and that I felt really made the title of the book so appropriate, is this idea, if I've got it right, of the role of the activist as archivist. So the activist, you say, is a historical political subject who feels historical and therefore documents things in that manner, that there's a kind of a documentary fetishism, as it were, at play here. Is that something that you noticed early on in the research and that it led you to develop the work in the way that it has? Or is it something that came to you after you just accumulated so much of this stuff yourself? What was the relationship between your gathering of the material and your thinking through this aspect of the argument?
Well, I think your question picks up on the fact that my analysis mirrors what the activists themselves were thinking. And so in many ways, they were the best experts of their own practices. And I did indeed kind of figure out a couple of strong connections, that the historicity of their political feeling was not only directly tied to the very strong continuing presence of the impact of 1998 in their lives, and even in younger activists who were indoctrinated by hearing stories about 1998 from their seniors, that this feeling historical was being actively cultivated, and that people were very aware, quite self-aware of the importance of documentation. So they would keep producing things, keep making things, keep filming and making videos to commemorate really the moment of their involvement in the democratic transition.
Is all of this what you mean after Derrida's archive fever as Pemuda fever? Is this what Pemuda fever consists of, or is there something more to it that we haven't yet touched on in the conversation?
I think so. I was, in fact, quite inspired by Derrida's archive fever, and then there was, of course, a kind of large art catalog produced by Okri Enwezor with the same title, which is about the drive to archive, the drive to consign, the drive to preserve, this feeling of being a steward or guardian over something, right, over which one claims ownership. And that was very present in amongst Indonesian activists. And what they were guarding was both the importance of the transition to democracy in 1998, but also this much longer historical trajectory and lineage of Pemuda nationalism in Indonesia. And activists would refer again and again to the idea of the Pemuda, specifically in the revolution and in the kind of early nationalist era, as inspiration. So I think all that iconography was not lost upon them. It was very present. And my coinage of the term Pemuda fever, I think, gets a little bit at why certain ideas became popular. And I used the word contagion to express it, because it was transmitted from one person to the other. And it really was a kind of, I think in many cases for young people, a peer experience where they were converted by friends or by sharing similar experiences, that they somehow found themselves and other people on the street through this kind of active street politics.
Is the reference to contagion makes me wonder about whether or not that's a reason that you sound a note of caution about the use of this term. Well, on the one hand, adopting it, that there's something about it which suggests a certain irrationality, perhaps, which is also not the message that you're delivering through this text?
Yeah, I note that, because I think there is, of course, in the historiography of Pemuda nationalism, a high degree of romanticism. And this is something Bill Frederick has written about as well in his work on Pemuda style, that there is a type of nostalgia and romanticism that tends to obscure the politics of the Pemuda themselves. And so I sound a note of caution, because I can see how people could take the term or misconstrue the presence of the irrational within mass politics. But rather, I want to say the feverish part is really about the affective sensation of being politicized, that there's an intensification of the feelings of solidarity, of involvement, of concern for the nation. So really, I'm trying to gesture towards an altered state of consciousness, right? So to link politicization with consciousness raising, and to take it in a more political direction rather than to kind of promote a kind of physiological understanding of crowd politics.
Well, with crowd politics, let's move from the archive to the streets, or perhaps to the street as archive, and to the demo, which you spent a lot of time at. Could you talk us through a demonstration? Just give us a sense of the emotions and sounds, the participants, the techniques for managing bodies, and the life cycle of a demo as you describe it in the book.
Yes. So here I'm kind of drawing on Marcel Mauss's The Techniques of the Body, but also ideas about expertise and discipline and management, because I think it's important to understand how much technical and logistical discipline is required to put together a demonstration, and how the Indonesian actors became extremely good at it. They became adept through experience. They learned from each other. They adapted their techniques over time, so that demonstrations of 1998, which inspired later demonstrations, did not look the same, and certainly were not as volatile as the ones in 1998. So demonstrations require a lot of meetings beforehand between various groups to cement an alliance, but to also commit facts and figures. So in planning meetings, people map out the timeline of the organization, as well as they assign important roles to various activists. So leadership roles, management roles, transportation roles, logistical roles, so on and so forth, communications, media relations, legal aid. These are all aspects of the demonstration that are planned beforehand. And in these planning meetings, people will commit, 30 activists or 50 demonstrators and so on and so forth. And at the actual day of the demo, the choice of the demo site is also quite important. People try to find a high visibility area which is considered safe and good and secure for demonstrations, with good passageways, something resembling public space. So people will gather in a park or a parking lot, and then move towards their designated location. They might conduct a march towards the destination and then hold a rally where people will hold speeches, and there will be a kind of elaborate sound system with rented speakers and handheld mics and so on and so forth. And sometimes activist groups will contribute music or performance art and other rather festive elements to the demonstration itself. At times, there might be some kind of encounter with security forces at the demo site. These may or may not turn violent. Really, often it does not. And at about 4 or 5 o'clock, there is a turn toward a kind of ritualized ending, and then people go home. And the passage home is also quite well organized. There are often public kind of minibuses that are rented for the occasion to ferry people back to their destinations. There might be an evaluation meeting that is carried out afterwards, but often people gather, eat, drink, and talk for hours after a demonstration. So it really is a huge time commitment.
What about the visual and material culture, which you alluded to earlier on? You say that there's a carefully cultivated style that passes through youth politics and through demos into the public domain. Please tell us a bit more about the features of that style, and perhaps also why was it that it emerged so forcefully from the late 1990s onwards?
Well, the uniform that I talk about in the book is perhaps one of the most accessible uniforms possible. It's a political t-shirt and jeans, maybe some kind of sneakers, some kind of sandals, sunglasses, a scarf, a hat. But the t-shirt and jeans is the basic uniform of the activists that they will wear everywhere they go. And sometimes groups will produce special t-shirts, special edition t-shirts for certain demonstrations so that people can wear them en masse and appear as a corporate group when they are on the site. So when I was conducting my research in 2004, 2005, this kind of style was very well developed, and each group that attended the demo site appeared quite uniform. They would also have matching banners and flags to announce their presence. There was a great deal of attention paid to the visuality of the demonstration itself so that it could have more impact beyond the number of bodies on the site. And especially good was bright colors and sort of very large slogans and banners that would look good on camera. So there was also that attention to media detail and effects that was, I think, purposefully cultivated in the student movement and in the activist movement more broadly.
With the commercialization of public space, what are the implications for the use of images like the iconic Che Guevara t-shirt image? Is it the case that they still retain their political contents, or are they somehow assimilated into other parts of public life, and consequently the meaning that your youth activists might attach to them is dissipated?
Well, I think one could read that in a variety of ways. The popularization of this type of style of wearing political t-shirts or satirical t-shirts, or kind of, t-shirts of commentary on contemporary issues, was pretty widespread, at least across Java. And if activist groups weren't making them, there were lots of vendors selling them. So it really was a style that became assimilated and became more mainstream. And I don't think that was a bad thing. I don't think it diluted youth politics, but rather it allowed people to identify with youth politics in a very accessible way. So if you were out in public space or you were out in the markets and you could see people wearing certain kinds of t-shirts that wouldn't have been banned even a decade before, you could sort of gauge that political conversation might be possible with such a person. So I think this is one of the ways that youth political culture entered into public culture and made certain subversive symbols more acceptable, more palatable in Indonesia post-Suharto.
Yeah, in fact, I'm just looking at a point that you make on page 97 of the text, where you say that the visual dominance of the mediatized activist image in the public sphere and its transposition onto an older Pemuda image ensured that the student body could never be truly stripped naked of its politicized identity. So is that the point that you're making there, that somehow it becomes in some ways integral to that larger political identity, and yet is also still distinctive? It still stands apart from it in some way.
Yes, I think so. The figure of the student activist, the emergence of this social type that has since become quite normalized and naturalized in Indonesian political life, I think the visual characteristics of the activist look really played a part in this, and worked as a kind of wink if you like, that it was a way of being political for many people without being extremely, let's say, outwardly or verbally declaratively political. But it already stood for something if you were daring enough to wear a political t-shirt and to look like a student activist.
So if there is this kind of acceptability and mediation of messages into the public space that didn't exist previously, then why do you end up that chapter on, it's the chapter on style, in fact it is, saying that nevertheless Indonesians are impatient for the student movement to please leave already? It sounds as if on the one hand there's a certain amount of enfolding in the public space and acceptability that comes with that, but still a resentment of some sort about the continued occupation of public space by your youth activists.
Right, I think there is a tension there, and this means that we have to take a longitudinal view at democratization and political transformations, because there are always counter movements at work, and there are always, I think, globally, a move towards, you know, a more sophisticated expression of right-wing politics, and that's certainly happening in Indonesia. And so there is a sense that reformasi is out of date or out of style, and so is student activism. So there is the expectation both for youth to be always at the forefront and always daring and breaking the rules, but there is also now, I think, the expectation that youth must be more mature or grow up and kind of must return to a normalized setting of social development. So there is indeed that tension at present, where what was welcome before has outstayed its welcome.
Well, maybe we'll return to that debate shortly near the end of the discussion. But before we get there, I'd like to move from the streets to other sites that you cover in the book, in the chapter with the title of Home. Yes. As you point out, of course, not everything happened in the streets, and you say that really to find out where, quote, activism was not only surviving but thriving, unquote, you had to go into other domains. Now, people may think that those other domains would be, well, the university campus, other public places, but not the streets themselves. But in fact, you go to sites that I'm probably going to pronounce incorrectly, but nevertheless, the Coast, Secret, the Base Camp, and perhaps quintessentially the POSCO. I have a string of questions about these places, but briefly, well, what were they? Where were they? Who was in them? How did you get to them? And how do you distinguish them as activist sites as against just any other place in the urban area of Jakarta?
Yes. So I was quite invested in thinking about how activist life reproduced itself. And if the demo was work, then where were the spaces of play and where were the places of rest and what did people do after the demonstration? And it turned out that activists still spent quite a lot of time together before and after the demo, and that there was a great deal of continuity between work and play. And so activist sociality really took place in the kinds of spaces that I described. So, for instance, in the Coast, which would be student lodgings or rented rooms, usually off campus for men and women, the secretariat, which would have been a kind of office, or also a slightly larger rented room or a small house that people used as their headquarters, and base camp, which kind of borrows the military term, but also served as organizational headquarters where activists would go and spend a lot of their time resting, eating, watching TV together, having late night discussions, or inviting guest speakers or foreign guests and journalists and so on and so forth. And lastly, the POSCO, which is perhaps the most ephemeral of all of these sites, a kind of emergency structure that would be assembled to address specific emergencies, where the people could go and make contact with activists and bring their concerns, or where people could drop off donations and come and volunteer their time and services. So it really kind of emerged through these spatial structures that activist life went far and beyond the campus and the streets.
You mentioned this continuity of work and play, and I'd like to dwell on that a moment longer before we continue with the time remaining to the other contents of the book, because I think one of the really important things about this chapter is the emphasis that you place on how the private and the public are enfolded together, how the boundaries of sociality and intimacy, as you put it, are blurred. Could you say something a little bit more about why it was important for you to emphasize that aspect of what you were observing?
Yes, and this is really to address, I think, the class question in this research, because most university students were privileged, were middle class, or even if they were from rural areas, had somehow acquired either enough social or economic capital to be in a city and to be a university student. So the great mystery, I think, of the 1990s was how activists became politicized and why it would be that middle class youth would turn away from a kind of what activists called a decadent lifestyle, a kind of westernized, consumptive lifestyle toward radical politics and really leftist politics. And so it was important to show that this work of politicization, of living an alternative life could take place in these shared activist spaces, such as rented homes and offices, off-site, as it were.
In the opening of the book, you describe all of the events that you set out as occurring in the shadow of multiple types of violence, physical, structural, and epistemological, the three. And a chapter of the book is dedicated to this topic, and you weave a discussion of these types into the chapter. But here you really bifurcate the conversation between violence and counter-violence in student politics. So one question you raise yourself that I'd like you to address again in our conversation is the question of why student counter-violence is so troubling to think about. And relatedly, a question that I have is, why do you make a move in your book against the literature on student counterviolence as an apolitical form of violence?
Yeah, I think this chapter was perhaps the hardest for me to write. Even at the dissertation stage, it went through many, many iterations and many, many explanations because I was trying my hardest to deconstruct a naturalizing narrative about student violence and also a culturalist explanation for student violence. And so I was sort of struggling against various narratives and on various fronts, one of which I mentioned in the book is what Indonesians call horizontal violence, right, which is the predominant explanation for outbreaks of violence at the grassroots level. So it's seen as taking place between equal parties, right? So there is no kind of explanation of inequality. Horizontal violence also is a way to depoliticize acts of violence because it usually tends to draw on essentializing explanations for why violence takes place. So that was certainly something I tried to avoid. And I also wanted to avoid, once again, linking youth with violence because I think that occurs time and again, to criminalize and demonize youth politics and to point to the irrationality of youth politics. Whereas I think in the student movement, and certainly in 1998 and after, student counterviolence always had a kind of meaning and always had a kind of message, whether it was about resistance to the state or a sense of justice. It was never devoid of meaning. So I want to also step away again from the explanation of spontaneous violence breaking out during the demo or in public, which was a very common way for the state to discredit student politics.
I think we need to be clear about what it is we're talking about here. Can you be more explicit about what form the violence, state violence, took, and give a little bit more information about the forms that student counterviolence took as well?
Yes, so the kinds of state violence that students experienced were quite extreme. They range from kidnappings in 1997 through early 98, torture, mass arrests or arbitrary detentions, trials for insulting the head of state. So there was a range of different violent tactics that the state kind of deployed against student activists. And also there were often kind of acts of violence at the demonstrations themselves. So either members of the army or riot police would beat students or would fire tear gas and so on and so forth. So that's the kind of range of state violence I'm talking about, where there were actual student deaths. Student counterviolence was more highly symbolic. So students in 1998 and 1999 would try to fight back by throwing rocks, throwing stones, and throwing Molotov cocktails. They would also provoke the security forces that they faced at demonstrations. They would sort of push back and use physical force. They would use their flags and their banners as weapons to hold their ground and to push back against the security forces. And in some of the more extreme cases of what I call counterviolence by students, as a kind of reaction to what they considered to be state violence, students also conducted sweepings where they would surround cars that belonged to the police, for instance, and try to overturn the cars or set them on fire without people in them. They would sweep individual members of the army or police that they found on streets or on public buses and try to humiliate them or bully them. So you can see that they're not proportionate responses, as it were, but they were very highly symbolic acts that people, I think the public felt quite ambivalent about when they witnessed it.
And I should add that you do have a number of very compelling accounts in the book that speak to these different types of violence. In particular, the one that stayed with me was the testimony of Iblis, the torture survivor. So I commend that part of the book to listeners interested in this aspect of the work that you did. Before we move to conclude in a few minutes on this topic of violence, could you say a little bit more about what are the epistemological features of the violence? How did violence function epistemologically in this setting?
Well, one of the important ways in which violence was present and it played a part epistemologically in student narratives was that I think it created a strong sense of solidarity amongst victims of state violence, especially across generations. And so it was very important for the category of victimhood to arise and for people to articulate the abuses they had either suffered or members of their family had suffered and friends of theirs had suffered as human rights abuses and as state abuses of power. So that was one of the very important features of how violence created community amongst activists.
You described the book as ending with a calculated guess at the pending historical outcome of Indonesia's protracted student movement. And this calculated guesswork, as you put it, I think there's more to it than that, but in any case, is situated in a discussion of how some youth leaders come to claim new roles after 1998 as doko, a term that I'd invite you to say a little bit about. Conditions of proliferating claims to ownership in some way or another of the legacy of 98, and these claims are supplemented and enlarged by the political economy of elections in Indonesia in 2004 and again in 2014. But in some ways, the story I got for those two elections is slightly different, and I'd be interested to hear you speak about it, because it seemed as if in 2004 what you were documenting were efforts by some of the Toko and others to institutionalize and engage in a new type of political action with the emergence of party politics, and that those efforts fail. And you say that post-Reformasi activism continues to thrive, as in the past, really, in moments of emergency. But in 2014, the impression you create in closing the book is really that the proximity of activist youths to civil society groups and the media, even if it hasn't transformed them themselves into politicians or propelled their organizations to the forefront of political action in the new era, nevertheless is proving to be significant for the politics of Indonesia in the current day. Witness what happened with Prabowo in the 2014 election. So would you care to comment on that? Have I got it right, or is there something else going on here that you think needs to be said?
No, I think your reading is quite spot on in that the political establishment have been learning from the student movement for quite some time, and this was evident even in 2004, hence the institutionalization and incorporation of former activists into formal politics and into political parties. And even the styles and the visual spectacles and the kind of social contracts that current politicians seem to offer in their attempts at populism, I think very closely emerge from Reformasi culture and from activist culture. And so there is a way in which some of these techniques have gone mainstream. And yet there is a sort of ambivalent outcome at the end of the book, which isn't quite about political disappointment. It isn't that I think student activists failed or that that's the right question to ask, but rather that there's something survives Generation 98, whether it's the activists themselves and their youth spirit or the expertise that they've accumulated over a decade and a half of political work, right, or almost two decades of political work that are still quite effective and continue to make impact in Indonesian political life. So that would be my read for the sort of, let's say, ephemeral presence of some of these figures from 98 in present day politics. That it may not be their full-time work, and yet they're still very much drawn to the world of politics and still very much intervene and participate and communicate at a very heightened level. Many of the activists that I knew have gone on to get master's degrees, have become professionals, have become fluent in English or other languages, and really are poised to be the best representatives of important and progressive issues in Indonesia today.
And is your current research keeping you in this space, or have you moved in another direction with the publication of this book?
My current work is somewhat related in that it's still about the urban and still about public spaces, but I'm currently working on a project that more closely looks at infrastructural changes in Indonesia and also kind of grassroots experience of economic change and financial inclusion. So I've become quite interested in urban informality in cities like Jakarta and how urban citizenship is becoming redefined in this era of kind of ramped up development and speculative investment.
And is there a new monograph planned at some time in the next few years? I know it might be a little bit premature to ask, given that this book has just come out, but nevertheless, listeners would be keen to know.
I've been writing a little bit about these new topics. So there are articles out here and there. I have an article on traffic in IJUR, in the International Journal of Urban and Regional Research, out last year that's related to my new subject, and I've been presenting this work at conferences and talks. But I should say a new book is probably a few years out from now. I definitely need to do a lot more field work and research.
Well, this one was very well worth waiting for, and I think I would commend it, congratulate you, and commend it not only as a powerful study of youth politics in Indonesia, but also as an exemplary study for scholars keen to do similar ethnographic work on youth politics elsewhere in Southeast Asia. So thank you again, Doreen Lee, for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to everyone for listening to Doreen talk about Activist Archives, Youth Culture and the Political Past in Indonesia on New Books in Southeast Asian Studies. I hope you enjoyed the discussion and that you'll join me, Nick Cheeseman, for another conversation with an author. And if you do have the time, please also check out the over 100 other New Books Network channels that are all freely available online. Monkey! Hey, thank God she gets in the boat. Monkey! Hey, thank God she gets in the boat.